actually just told him to make it as brief as possible. That could talk for ages. I'm actually delighted to have actually here tonight. I'm looking forward to actually coming for ages. I don't actually know actually that well personally, but I've definitely got a sense of connection with actually just from seeing the last Dharma talk he gave me, and from briefly meeting him in India when we went to Sarnath, where the Buddha first taught, and we saw actually teaching the Dharma to some Indian mitras out there. Actually, I was ordained by Bhante in New Zealand when I was 8 months old. Makes me a little bit more senior than near me. I just want to briefly say that actually I spent a long time in New Zealand in the early days of the movement, a long way away from the nucleus and the centre of the movement, and the movement was just kind of starting to sort of take shape, and no one really knew what was going on then. But I actually stayed in New Zealand quite committed, teaching the Dharma to people, which I just find so inspiring. I personally need so many sort of supportive conditions around it, but the idea of these sort of pioneers like actually just really sort of inspired me. One other thing I'll say, I'll keep it brief. Actually, it's going to talk about the Pabhaja Sutta, which is relating to sort of going forth. Actually, I spent quite a lot of time in India teaching and so on, and moves around quite a bit. He has 10 kilograms of belongings that fit into a bag that can fit on a plane. That is it. That is it. I mean, not kind of like, I just found, he's got that, a bank account and an email address. Which I just find like genuinely just really inspiring. It's like practicing what you preach, absolutely. Yeah, so I'm delighted to have you here, actually, and welcome.
Thank you very much. I do feel I've been given a great welcome here. This is my local Buddhist centre because I'm spending some time in Lincoln with my mother. And I went to school in Britain, but I kind of don't know it quite so well. So when I come to Britain and come to places like this, I feel very at home. So nice to be here. And it's often said that any Triratna centre has got a certain quality, a je ne sais quoi. You can't quite put your finger on it, but it's got a similarity with other Buddhist centres in the Triratna. And I certainly feel this, like I suppose the centre I know the best is in Wellington, New Zealand, very long way away, and I know a lot of centres in India, but I feel, a kindred spirit in this room. So that's very nice. And I suppose one of the things that brings us all together is our founder, Sangha Rakshita. And one of the things that's good about being an order member who's long in the tooth, if you know that expression, an old order member, is that I've had plenty of time around and I've seen quite a lot of Sangha Rakshita over many years. And I can't speak highly enough about him. In fact, I've only got to think of him and upwells, a sense of reverence and positivity and goodwill. And I know I'm not alone in this. So many people feel like that. So I'd like to start with a little bit of, just a little bit of praise for this man who's completely changed my life and changed the lives of so many other people. So I think the first thing I think about is his kindness. And I remember the very first time I ever saw him and him walking in the room. And you really felt looked at. You really felt he may not be talking loudly, may not be saying very much, but he really sees you. You go and see him on a one-to-one interview, you really see he's, with you, totally concentrated. And then over the years, as so many people do, I had my ups and I had my downs. I had my angry feelings against the Triratna or against Sangha Rakshita, and I had, other feelings. But he was always there as a presence, and not just with me, but with other people. He always saw the very best in me, and I thought, he's seeing something in me that I haven't seen in myself. But he wasn't just it wasn't idle flattery. He really could see your potential and the best qualities. So that was all his kindness. And I could easily spend the whole evening talking about Sangha Rakshita, and perhaps I should one night, but I'll just mention a couple of other things. His mindfulness. You watch him walking up and down, and you think, there's a very mindful man. You listen to him talking. He doesn't just blah, 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 blather away. He's very conscious of every word, the meaning, what he's saying, where the thing's going. And his ability to absorb detail and pay attention to lots of things is quite extraordinary. His powers of observation, I suppose you'd say, is quite extraordinary. And sometimes he would visit New Zealand and write about it later, and I thought, God, I didn't see any of these things he's writing about, but he could see all these other things that I had missed. Things about society, things about the physical environment, and so on. But last but not least, he's such a great Buddhist teacher. And, of course, one of the things he's able to do is present Buddhism to us in the West in a way that's, you know, in the medium of Western culture. We don't have to learn all about Thai culture or Japanese culture or something like that. We don't have to wear those Japanese clogs or anything to get it, you know, and it's very direct. And where appropriate, he's made lots of links with the great Western thinkers and artists like Nietzsche and Blake. One of his great favourites seems to be Samuel Johnson, who I don't know too much about, but I gather Samuel Johnson was very precise, so he likes that. And even a local hero, D.H. Lawrence, he's had some very nice things to say about D.H. Lawrence, and I remember him talking very favourably about D.H. Lawrence's novel The Rainbow. Of course, in a way, D.H. Lawrence is a local man here, so I mention him amongst many, many others. So, I could also say that in India, he's able to adapt Buddhism to the Indian scene, the contemporary Indian scene, and he pitches it just right. He was working with those people over there for a long time. He knows, you know, how to make it really relevant to their lives, which is so different to our lives. But for all that, can pitch it to Westerners, can pitch it to Indians, he never deviates from the core of the Buddha's teaching, and especially the principles behind what the Buddha taught. And he takes his inspiration, very strong inspiration, from the historical Buddha, and of course from all the great Buddhist sages over the centuries. But you feel he's very, very in touch with the historical Buddha. So in some ways you could say he's a traditionalist. You know, I suppose he's not such a New Age type of Buddhist, he's a traditionalist. Now of course the historical Buddha, he lived some time ago. In fact, Christ seems a long time ago, but then to think that the Buddha was even 500 years before that, you think, well, what sort of connections could we have? How could we know about his life and what he taught? Well, we're rather lucky. We've got some scriptures, some texts that are dated as being, you know, that from the earliest sort of sources, and we can be pretty sure they come very, very close to reporting on what the Buddha said and what he did and about his life. And there's a lot of these, and taken together, they add up to a very inspiring picture. And we have a very cogent and clear idea of his core teachings. There's a whole story about how these got preserved, initially for hundreds of years through an oral tradition. One group of followers reciting them to another group. And so it's quite wonderful that we've got such good records. So what I'm going to do tonight is just take one of these many records, and it's one or two pages long in translation into English, and it's called the Pabaja Sutta. Sutta means sort of thread or early scripture. And it's got a story about the Buddha and some teachings in it as well. So first of all, I'm going to tell the story. Then I'm going to draw something out of the story, interpret it a little bit, and say how that story can change the way we live our lives and what the teachings are. And then there'll be, hopefully, question and answers. So the story. I've taken a little bit of historical information from some other places. as well as what's in this one or two page scripture. So the Buddha starts by explaining in this scripture why he left home. And in leaving home, he became a wanderer, and he was following in a very well understood and recognized tradition of that culture at that time. You had family people doing farming and trading and all sorts of other things, and then intermingling with them were all these wanderers, and they wandered around on foot, around the countryside, around the cities, and sometimes even in the jungle. And in the jungle was very difficult, as you can imagine. Snakes, tigers, mosquitoes, hard to get much food. But some of them, you know, spent quite a lot of time in the jungle. And they were respected, highly respected. Probably in those days, they didn't respect the businessman nearly as much as they would respect the wanderer. And they wanted to support these people because these people were, we could say, in quest of spiritual truth. They, like us, just like us, they wanted to find out, you know, what life was about. How could they develop their mind and feel free and not troubled by the problem of death and these sorts of things. So the people happily gave to them. It wasn't like begging because they were, you know, at the rock bottom of society. And there were all sorts of people doing this. Some of them were Jains. You might have heard of the religion of Jainism. There were all sorts of ideas. Some people, you know, believed in torturing their bodies as a way to spiritual uplift. All sorts of different practices. So the Buddha sort of joined that whole kind of group of wanderers. And he gives his reasons in this scripture. He says, I wanted to do it because when I was living at home, I found it too cramped and I found the atmosphere in the home too dusty. Now, I'm going to say some explanation of what he might have meant later on. And then he says, as a wanderer, I purified my life in everything I did, or I tried to purify my mind. I tried to act in a way out of purity. And then he goes back in time and he reflects on a particular time in his life, on a particular vignette, a particular incident that happened. And this is something that happened before he was fully enlightened, but after he'd left home. So you get a sense of the Buddha. Well, he wasn't really the Buddha then, actually, because technically the Buddha is the awakened one, the one who understands, and he hadn't achieved full enlightenment, so he wasn't quite the Buddha, but I'm going to call him the Buddha for simplicity, and because you do sense he was already an extraordinary person even before he was enlightened. So he had left home, and he was begging food in a city called Rajagriha. And it's a mountain city, and it's near a particular peak called the Vulture's Peak. And some people who go on pilgrimage go to the Vulture's Peak, such as some people in this room have been there. I have never been. But this is no longer a city now, Rajagriha, but in those days, 2,500 years ago, it was a booming place. It was the capital of a kingdom called Magadha. When it was a wealthy place, it was a growing city. There was obviously a lot of river trade up and down the Ganges, very fertile plains, no overpopulation like there is today. And they had iron and copper mines. So this is where the king lived, King Bimbisar, king of Magadha. And one day he was just looking out from his palace, presumably, looking at the people in the city, and he saw somebody who just immediately attracted his attention. And the text says it was the Buddha, actually. The Buddha said, the king says, King Bimbisara, that man, he is so mindful. He's still some distance away, but I can tell. He's so handsome. His complexion is beautiful. The way he walks is so attractive. And his eyes are just cast a little distance ahead. He's not looking all over the place. He's not trying to attract attention. He's just so focused. Now, as I've said, there were a lot of wanderers in India at that time. But the Buddha stood out, even just from a distance, according to this record, as exceptional. So the king said to his advisors, I want you to follow that man and tell me what he's doing, where he goes. So some scouts kind of tailed him, I suppose, a bit like sleuths. And the Buddha collected some food to eat, and he took the food away into a sort of hilly area. And then he ate the food very mindfully, and he had some friends there who he was with. And then one of the scouts who'd observed all this came back to the king, King Bimbisar, and said, I'd seen him, and he's sitting on this particular hillside, and he's sitting there like a lion, like a tiger, like a bull. And so the king was impressed even further and said, I must meet the Buddha. He didn't know who he was, he just this little bit of information. Buddha didn't have a big reputation in those days. So he went out in a party to meet him, and the first part of the journey maybe on an elephant, but then he'd have to dismount and go into the mountain area by walking. And the two men met, and they exchanged greetings, and the king said, I'm very impressed with your appearance. Tell me where you're from. Tell me about your background. And the Buddha said, well, I come from another kingdom, the kingdom of Kosala, and I come from a community, a people, who are very strong and healthy and wealthy, the Shakyam people. So he's very sort of confident about his cultural background. And then the king said, you would be very good at leading a great army. I can see from your qualities. And if you want to, I can help you have a lot of wealth and, of course, a lot of social status. Won't you please join me? Won't you please be one of my top people in my government? But, of course, as you can imagine, Buddha wasn't tempted. And he just simply said, I have seen that craving leads to unhappiness. And then he sort of spoke or sang a sort of verse that comes at the end of the scripture, and the verse says, I will go on with the struggle. This to me is delight. This is where I find bliss. So that's the story. And I want to, as I said, draw out some threads from this very, very simple story, because we can just read it and just miss so much so easily from the scriptures. So first of all, the reasons he gave for leaving home. It doesn't really make any sense to think that the Buddha left home because he wanted more physical comfort. Actually, as far as we know, his family were quite wealthy. He had a nice house. Later Buddhist scriptures talk about a palace, but we can at least think it was a very comfortable sort of place. And the life of these wanderers was so much more difficult than the life of a modern monk. And nothing like a modern monk. A modern monk has security, somewhere to sleep every night, regular meals. They don't need to sort of take any initiative if they don't want to. These wanderers, they often had to go hungry because sometimes they didn't get any food. Sometimes, very often, they slept under trees. They were living rough. So the Buddha wouldn't have gone out for the sake of physical comfort. But of course, it's a metaphor. There are metaphors, not having enough space, and life at home was dusty. If you've been to India at certain time of year, sort of pre-monsoon, you know that actually India is a very, very dusty place. And it's not just inside the houses that are dusty. Everywhere is sort of very, very fine dust, and it gets into your hair, into your into everything. So it would have been dusty outside as well. The Buddha often used metaphors in his teaching. I don't know if you know the Dhammapada, but the Dhammapada is absolutely saturated with metaphors, and it's a very good way of teaching. It's making a comparison with some physical thing in the world to communicate a mental experience. So, for instance, the Buddha says, people struggle and suffer like fish in shallow water. So obviously he doesn't mean that we're breathing underwater and that sort of thing, you know, but if you look at fish and imagine them in shallow water and you can think how much difficulty and hardship there is in that life, you say, well, actually human life is quite a lot of suffering and quite a lot of discomfort and disease. So he's using a metaphor. Or he might say, craving is like an iron chain that holds people down. So he doesn't mean that they literally got a chain, but it's a metaphor for, you know, the restriction of that sort of thing. So these metaphors, not enough space. Well, I don't know if you can imagine maybe living in a very small room or being in a corridor where you can't quite even turn around. But when you are lacking in physical space, you feel, if you're at all claustrophobic, very, very uncomfortable. You feel you can't do the things you want to do. You feel just a lack of ease. So this is kind of like how the Buddha would have felt with his home life. There was, you know, all the comforts were there. People were very nice. He was very successful, you know, socially and everything. But there would have been a lot of social obligations and cultural obligations that made it very difficult for him to practice spiritually. A lot of distractions. I don't know whether you agree with this, but it said, if you've really started to get a taste for your potential in terms of spiritual development, if you've really started to imagine, really started to feel, really started to think for yourself, if you try to squash that, if you try to, just live a very meaningless life, it's extremely painful. So this is, I think, what the Buddha was feeling when he said there wasn't much space. But you could say, well, what about us? We can't become wanderers. In fact, I don't think there's any such thing in the modern world as a wanderer. As I said, so many monks in Asia become monks out of necessity. I was recently talking to a Cambodian monk, he'd be about 30, and he said, well, there was a war in Cambodia, my father died, my mother had no money, so I was sent to the monastery. It's as simple as that. And you get the same story in many other Asian countries, and then you see that many Asian monks, not all of them, some are very good monks, but some of them you just feel they're out there for an easy, comfortable life. So I don't suggest that you should all become nuns and monks. But what I think it does mean for us is we should respect our urge for spiritual development and try to live in a way that kind of supports that rather than hinders it. And of course, there's lots and lots of dimensions. We need to think about the type of work we do, whether it's ethical, whether it leaves our mind all frazzed up. I had a job for years as a policy analyst. It was interesting, it was well paid, but by gosh, it was stressful. And so I remember so many times going to front, you know, Buddhist classes, teaching, and I was in absolutely no fit state to do so. And it really wasn't very, very good in that particular respect. So we need to think about our work, who we socialize with, the effects of different friends have on us, how we use our spare time, are we watching a lot of B-grade television things, and all these sorts of things. And we could have, again, separate talks on each of the main areas of life. And then he says, inside the building, inside his home, the Buddha felt there was a lot of dust, and of course dust is an irritant. It makes you feel sort of less than happy, less than relaxed. So he would have felt that all these social restrictions and obligations to be an irritant, considering that he already had a very high, strong aspiration that he couldn't ignore. Then he says, I purified my life in everything I did. So you could say, well, sounds good, but what really is a pure life? And you say, well, pure life is developing a pure mind. What's a pure mind? Well, it's easy to say, but a mind with no craving, no hatred, no confusion, no fear, positive emotions, clarity, mindfulness. And we can think of, using metaphors again, we can think of gold. That in its pure state, gold is beautiful, it's lustrous, it's strong, but often in nature it's mixed up with impurities, and so people have to take the impurities out to get the pure gold. So that's what the Buddha was trying to do in everything he did. He was trying to purify his mind. It's a very nice conception of what our minds are like. It's as if the basic feeling is that, well, we've got these sort of areas of confusion and difficulty and problem, but they can be dispensed with, and what we're left with is pure consciousness, which is resplendent. And so that was the Buddha's task. We too could try to apply it, but the interesting thing is he says, in everything I did. The Buddha wasn't a part-time Buddhist. He was applying his mind when he was begging, as we know from the story, when he was in discussion with other people, presumably when he was sleeping, he was applying mindfulness and reflection in everything, when he was walking, in all situations. And of course we can apply Buddhism in all situations, when we're cooking, when we're on the toilet, when we're doing our teeth, we're catching the bus, when we've just missed the bus and we're feeling frustrated, we can still apply Buddhism in one way or another. For instance, we could take the area of sleep as an example. Well, we can be more mindful of our sleep, and we can have a sense that within our dream experience, we can derive a lot of wisdom, and we can reflect about our dreams and learn something from them, and even have a sense of, you know, that the dreams have, they show us something about our own mind, about the world. We should try not to just be Buddhists when we're, and practice Buddhism when we're inspired, but try and have a consistency. I've seen so many people go on retreats, especially longer retreats, and often on the longer beginners retreats, at the end, there'll be a whole crop of mitra requests. And there's great excitement in the air. And especially if we, in New Zealand, if we had our president along, and he's, you know, very good presence. But then I observed the people, you know, in the weeks and months following that, and people found it sometimes hard to keep up even basic meditation, let alone inspiration and, you know, remembering dreams and this sort of thing. So we've got to try and be consistent. We might be thinking, well, ethics is a very, very important part of Buddhism, and of course none of us can say that our ethics is perfect. It's always an area where we can apply ourselves more. We might try to apply it to our life at the Buddha Center, being nice and mindful and courteous to other people, might apply it in our work, but maybe go home and have a, you know, an ethical relationship with our family or something. So often there's gaps. Or somebody might be very inspired by the Buddha and do rituals every day, sometimes every morning. Often Asians do this. They put light candles and incense and flowers, and then they'll recite a scripture full of good feelings, but then they'll go catch a bus to work and their mind is just, you know, in a mindless daydream, and they'll come back in the evening and just watch the B-grade movies on television. So not consistent. So the Buddha was consistent. He was motivated. Then, trying to speed up a little bit, the king, King Bimbisara, said of the Buddha, he's got a pleasing appearance. He said he was mindful. Well, as I said, if somebody's really at a very high level of mindfulness, you can tell from everything about them, the way they move their bodies, the way they talk. Then he says the Buddha had good complexion. Well, you will know from your experience that at those times when you're inspired or you're just, you know, having a really good metta-bhavana or something, you feel physically good. There's a physical sort of side effect. You don't do it necessarily for, you know, a physical tonic, but if you are feeling inspired or in a positive mind state, of course it has such a very good effect on us. I see this, you know, sometimes leading a meditation group, and we all meditate together, and I look up at the people just to check that everyone's okay. And some people have really got, they're just really cruising in, you know, something like the feeling of metta very strongly, and you can just see a sort of glow. And so it's very easy to imagine that the Buddha, with all these golden mental states, would have a very good complexion. And I think we know from our own lives too that when we're consumed with negative emotion like anxiety, blood drains from out of our face, we just feel physically weak, you know, it has a bad physical effect on us too. Of course you can't say, oh, she or he has a bad complexion, they must be very unspiritual, because of course there's all other factors as well. Like they may have just had some, you know, some very poisonous food, or they might have had a car accident and damaged their liver or something. So there's lots of possibilities, but you can well imagine the, you know, the principle that if you're enjoying very, very beautiful states of mind, it has a good effect on the body. So then the Buddha's just looking a short distance ahead. So he's not boastful. He's not looking around to try and attract attention. He's not worried whether people are noticing him or not noticing him. He's just totally focused. He's not in any way trying to garner fame, you know, because he's quite spiritually developed already. But boastfulness is actually a problem for many people. Of course, it's a problem in the world. People who've got a lot of money, they conceited about their wealth. People who very good looking, might, or very famous, they might be conceited about those sorts of things. But surprisingly and unfortunately, even Buddhists get so conceited about their spiritual practice in one way or another. Heaven forbid, I hope I never get conceited about being an order member of many years. In fact, some ways it embarrasses me because I think I ought to be a better person than I am after all those years. But people do get conceited about the number of hours they spend meditating, the position they have in an organisation, all sorts of things. I mean, I know and I heard of an Indian order member, and he was counting the hours he spent meditating. And he was counting because there was a big number, not a small number. And then, you know, over a long period of time, he could tell people, oh, you know, I've been meditating all this time. And so, you know, the risk of boastfulness is there for a very long time. Not until we really undercut the sense of ego, which requires some deep reflection and deep understanding, can we really, does that completely go? And in the meantime, for most people, we have to watch our ego, we have to watch that we don't boast or, you know, exaggerate things always in our favour, and just keep be careful of it. There's many stories about people who were very famous, highly regarded Buddhists, and, you know, they got hungry for power in one form or another. So, but the Buddha didn't seem to have that particular problem, and he was focused. He wasn't playing with his iPad as he was going around looking for food. he wasn't sort of wondering about you know, whether he'd get a mobile phone call from somebody. He was able to be totally contented in doing whatever he was doing, even when it was something quite simple. And then there's the scout came back and reported to the king. He said, "The Buddha, he's sitting there in his mountain lair, like a lion, like a tiger, like a bull." So these are all confident animals, not like a mouse, perhaps. And in other Buddhist scriptures, it's often said that when the Buddha's teaching, it's like a lion roaring. And this isn't to mean that the Buddha spoke very loudly, but a lion in the jungle has no enemies. There's no other creature that would attack it and, you know, get the better of a lion, because the lion being so strong and majestic. So this was the feeling of the Buddha. He was totally confident and totally relaxed in his presentation. So even though that kind of confidence might be a long way ahead of us in our lives, and sometimes we might have quite big dips in our self-confidence, nonetheless, self-confidence is a very good quality as a human being and something to aspire to. And self-confidence isn't about being loud or being boastful or having to tell people how great you are. But I've got a rough and ready description of what seems to me the qualities of a self-confident person. First of all, they're prepared to admit their faults. And if they're being criticized, being confident, their mind remains quite calm. They don't feel gutted. If they're being praised, a confident person's mind remains very calm. They feel okay about their age, about their gender, sexual orientation, and ethnicity. They don't feel unsettled when they meet somebody else who's got completely different philosophy, completely different way of thinking. And they feel relaxed in all the different situations, different social situations, kind of business environment, wealthy people, working class people, all sorts. They're happy to be alone. They feel at home when themselves alone. And probably the most important thing is a confident person is able to think their own thoughts without it necessarily tallying with the prevailing social attitudes. And it sounds very simple to say we can think our own thoughts, but very few people can say that they're really able to genuinely think their own thoughts, you know, and not be just parroting what we hear in the news and what we hear from friends. So moving on, the Buddha said, craving brings unhappiness. Now I was going to say quite a lot about all this, but maybe I'll just say what craving is, first of all. It's overemphasizing a temporary pleasure to try and blot out or mask over an underlying dissatisfaction with life, an underlying discontent. And the example that's often given is food. If we have a healthy appetite, we're not craving for food, then we enjoy the food. When we've taken enough for our physical needs, we feel great, and our mind is peaceful. If it's all motivated our eating from craving, we take enough for our body, but we kind of want something more out of it. We're trying to, you know, get something extra, and we don't feel peaceful and contented. And of course, people crave for all sorts of things, gambling, status, people's attention, all the substances. In India, it's a lot of people crave for pan, which is a sort of, I don't know, it's a herb or tobacco that they chew, and they spit out these red spittle all over the place. But it's a very, you get a taxi driver and you can see from their face what a strong craving it is and how they need to get their hits at regular times all through the day. So People who crave are often not happy just to sit and do nothing. But if we want to get somewhere in our spiritual life, we have to try and become contented and happy to sit for at least for good lengths of period doing nothing. Maybe meditation's a bit like that, but sometimes just it's okay just to sit, not to turn on the telly, just sit and do nothing. So how to overcome craving was a big subject, not much time, but I'll just give a couple of hints. One thing is, if there's a particular thing we crave, we can reflect on that thing and think, well, simple example, chocolate, will chocolate really make me happy? And the more deeply we can reflect, the more we'll kind of see, well, only to a limited extent, actually. And what I really want is something beyond that. But the best way to overcome craving is to develop contentment and happiness, and inner happiness, so we're not always needy, we're not always trying to fill out a discontent with life. And that takes us into the whole discussion of enjoying beauty, enjoying the arts, enjoying the beauty of nature, enjoying friendships more, and finding things that are good for us spiritually, but also deeply pleasurable. And so rather than trying to overcome our cravings just by willpower has its place, but we also need to consciously enjoy ourselves and enjoy ourselves in a healthy, wholesome sort of way. Then finally, the Buddha says, I will go on with the struggle. So this is one way of seeing our life and spiritual life as a sort of struggle. Many people just coast in life. They don't think about the big questions. They don't feel that they need to help the world or be idealistic. But as soon as you become a very idealistic person with vision and aspiration, then, you know, there will be some difficulties ahead. I mean, we've all got a deep down tendency to be selfish. So if we want to apply spiritual values and be ethical, then it will be a little bit of a difficulty because we've still got our selfishness. When, say, we get interested in spiritual life, we hear about mindfulness, but we need to use quite a bit of effort and consistent effort to sustain our mindfulness all through the day. So there is an element of steady effort, you could say, and willfulness. We have to use some effort to get rid of addictions. But that's only half of the truth. You could also say, and I hope you can say this from your experience, that our spiritual life is a joy and an inspiration, and it doesn't bear thinking about what it would be like if we didn't have a spiritual life and a spiritual direction. And of course, we can't maintain our spiritual practice if it's lackluster, just all based on willpower, and there's no pleasure. The only way to maintain all the things that we do is to find some pleasure within it and inspiration. And there are lots of pleasures, like the joy of really feeling reverence for the Buddha, or enjoying the beauty of life and the experience of metta. Very, very pleasurable. Of course, we don't feel it every time we do the metta bhavana, but when we do experience it, really feeds us with a deeper, deeper sort of contentment that really no amount of pampering in material ways would ever compensate for. So I think we can say from this short scripture that the Buddha's approach, even at this time in his life, was very balanced. Yes, he was very determined. Yes, he could sort of use willpower and saw life as a struggle, but he also got a lot of pleasure, and that's reflected in the final verse. I will go on with the struggle. This is a delight to me. This is where I find bliss. So just a brief summary. The Buddha found his home life restrictive, and he had such a big aspiration for spiritual development that he left and joined the community of wanderers. And that the implications for us is that we must think very hard about the way we live our lives and what we can do so that we don't feel restricted. We feel we've got plenty of space and we haven't got metaphorical irritants around us all the time. We should apply the principles of Buddhism in all situations. We should use willpower, but also look for pleasures in our spiritual practice. And one of those pleasures, as I've said, is inspiration from the Buddha. And from this scripture, we can take inspiration from his very strong sense of purpose and direction. He already had a lot of understanding. For instance, when he says, "I understand that craving leads to unhappiness," he understood it very deeply. For us, it might just be a bit of theory, but he really, really knew this. The Buddha's mindfulness, his lack of boastfulness, his confidence, and his enjoyment of life. So there you have it. That's the Pabbaja Sutta. I hope maybe one day some of you will, or I hope all of you, read it, because it's a simple, easy read. So now I wanted to go through it quickly because you may have some questions, either about meditation or about the sutta. And if, oh, thank you. So any questions?
Actually, you're talking about the importance of self-confidence and so on, and you seem to me like you have a sort of natural confidence that I'm sure has been built up over the years. But you told me earlier that you were very shy. I was just wondering yourself what you sort of actually done in your sort of Dharma practice that's developed this sort of someone that's not shy and seems quite sort of confident within himself.
It's an interesting question. I don't claim to be self-confident myself, but it does strike me when I look around senior order members just how many of them are very, very self-confident, and it shows. I don't want to sort of mention a whole string of names, but almost without exception, it seems to be the case. And I think to some extent, it just is a product of continuous spiritual practice over years. Certainly, if one could ever say that one had reduced ego, reduced the sort of delusion that you are a fixed, separate self, independent from the rest of the world, that undermining of ego would result in confidence, self-confidence. You no longer have a reputation to protect.